I recognize the gentleman from California, Mr. Edwards, for purposes of debate only and not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Edwards.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I always listen with keen interest to our eloquent colleague from New Jersey. I think that the facts with regard to the leaks are, of course, unfortunate, but I don't think it is really accurate to say that the leaks came all from this side. It has been made very clear by the press and by others that the faucet dripped from both taps, the hot and the cold. Insofar as the evidence that was released that my friend Mr. Sandman criticized, I voted against that too. But I think it should be pointed out that the President's counsel, Mr. St. Clair, was here. He was a part of all of these proceedings, and he recommended very strongly to the committee that this evidence be released. Mr. Chairman, there's been some mention made by some of our colleagues tonight regarding the Supreme Court decision. And I think that we should remember that the Supreme Court was very explicit in the decision. The evidence that will be released to Mr. Jaworski has only to do with the criminal trial that will, the trials that will take place. It will take several months, perhaps, for the production, the examination, the deciphering of these tapes. And then only the relevant portions to the criminal trials will be given to the special prosecutor. The remainder will be sealed and returned to the White House. Our needs with regard to this large impeachment inquiry are much wider. Our needs are much wider in scope than those of the special prosecutor and in the criminal case. And incidentally, our subpoenas still remain in effect. And we invite the White House, the President, to honor those subpoenas. And it certainly would make our job a great deal easier. And I think that the President should be reminded that the Supreme Court rejected his claim of absolute privilege. But, Mr. Chairman, this is one member who thinks that the welfare of the country dictates that we proceed deliberately, but with due speed in this undertaking that has been assigned to us by the full House of Representatives. And I would hope that the committee does not consider any delay because of the Supreme Court decision. Mr. Chairman, you and I and our 36 other colleagues and our splendid staff have worked here in room 2141 Rayburn for many weeks. We've learned much about the President and all the President's men, and indeed quite a lot about each other. More importantly, I think, we have relearned a lesson, and we are indebted substantially to Mr. Dorr, Mr. Jenner, Mr. Cates, and the fine members of the staff for this relearning process. This is a lesson that we were all taught in school and by our parents, and which we in turn try to pass on to our children. And it has to do with the value and beauty of our Constitution and the understanding that representative government, if it is going to work, requires that we all respect and obey the Constitution. And that means all 220 million of us. It's the compact we have with each other that enables us to live together in peace, to pursue happiness in raising our children and enjoying our friends. It requires that we treat one another with decency and respect when we're at work and when we're at school. It's the cement that holds us together as a decent and humane society. The President of the United States is also a citizen, just like the rest of us, and the Constitution applies to him also. In many respects, and that was pointed out earlier tonight, more so because he has a lot more power than any of us has. Our founders recognized this. They recognized the frightening power that the president has, that we give the president, and the grave danger to the republic should he abuse it. And so they very specifically inserted in this Constitution that he should be removed by Congress should he gravely abuse this power, and I emphasize the word gravely. Mr. Chairman, all our colleagues are dedicated people and excellent lawyers. Our committee, in its seemingly endless weeks of deliberations, I think behaved rather well, in accordance with the American traditions of due process and fair play. We invited the president's talented attorney to be a part of this process, to call his own witnesses, to question our witnesses, and to present every facet of the president's case. I agree with my colleague, Mr. McClory, that we can take some pride in our efforts to be impartial and fair. But we are divided on the question of whether or not President Nixon's violation of the Constitution threatened the American government, the liberties of the people, and the Constitution itself. Yes, we disagree on whether or not the evidence supports the serious charges that are contained in this bill of impeachment that was delivered to each of us tonight. I would most certainly accept Mr. St. Clair's premise that a direct connection must be proved between the president and the alleged offenses. I strongly disagree, however, when he argues that the case against the president is based only upon inferences, one piled on the other. There, I strongly disagree. Both Mr. St. Clair and Mr. Garrison insist that the only basis for this impeachment inquiry rests on whether or not the president was by intent a participant in the Watergate cover-up. These two fine lawyers should get high ranks from the president for their efforts to limit the scope of this inquiry, and certainly our job would be much easier if we could accept this thesis. Unfortunately for the president's defense, this is not the case, and the thousands upon thousands of evidence that we have reviewed in these past week etch a much broader picture. Indeed, a presidential course of constitutional misbehavior and abuse of power commencing only a few months after he was inaugurated for the second time and continuing until the present. Where then do I find myself? Yes, I have disagreed politically with the president for more than 20 years. Like my dear friend and colleague on my left, Bob Kastenmeier, I've had to subject my motives to the test of whether or not, if the shoe were on the other foot, if we were judging a Democratic president and one with whose views I agreed with, how would I vote? Well, I've searched my conscience. I've examined and re-examined the evidence, listened to the tapes, questioned the witnesses, listened to my colleagues, questioned the witnesses, subjected myself to the excellent briefings by the staff. I've tried to keep in mind the principles of the Constitution and due process. And I have made up my mind. And I don't make it up with my decision is not going to bring me great joy. Mr. Nixon is a fellow Californian. He was a candidate for the Senate in 1950, and I was a supporter of his in 1950. There's an awful lot of personal and family tragedy involved in this whole thing. It's terribly unfortunate. So there isn't anybody on this committee that is going to be delighted with his vote to impeach. But I do believe, and this is the way I'm going to vote, that the president has consciously and intentionally engaged in serious misdeeds that he has corrupted and subverted our political and governmental processes to the extent that he should be impeached and the matter sent over to our sister body, the Senate, for trial to determine whether he is innocent or guilty. A number of my colleagues on the committee, a majority, I think, and I are prepared to present what we think in the next few days is an overwhelming evidence to support this conclusion. On my part, I'm willing to face my constituents, my family, myself, and history with this sober conclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I recognize the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Railsback, for purposes of debate only, not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Railsback.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee. Let me begin by saying that you, Mr. Chairman, I think, in a rather difficult assignment, and although I haven't agreed with you, as you know, on many occasions, I think that you've handled yourself very well. And I think I can say for the most members of the committee that during these 6 months, the 7 weeks of looking through the 38 volumes of evidence, the listening to the live witnesses morning, afternoon, and night, that I can be proud of my judiciary colleagues, most of them. I feel badly, as Charlie Sandman did, about the leaks, the selective leaks, some of which I think the newspapers made a mistake in playing, although I know they have a job to get the news. Let me say, Mr. Chairman, that I used to like to be on the House Judiciary Committee when we were worried about penal reform and juvenile delinquency, trying to improve some very important things in our country that needed improving. But I'm about to reconsider my assignment now that we've had amnesty, abortion, impeachment, and now a bomb threat. Let me say that I am one of those that has agonized over this particular inquiry. I think it would be difficult for me, frankly, to consider impeaching a Democratic president. I regard it as an awesome responsibility, one that I don't relish at all. One that is particularly difficult for me because we are considering impeaching a man, Richard Nixon, who has been in my district twice campaigning for me, that I regard as a friend, that has only treated me kindly whenever I've had occasion to be with him. I am not one of those that would try to demean his or derogate his record. In my opinion, Richard Nixon has done many wonderful things for this country, particularly in the field of foreign affairs, and someday the historians are going to recognize the contributions that he's made. Let me say that I've been asked by members of the press whether my arm has been twisted because I'm one of the six or seven Republicans that have been undecided. And I can answer that with an unequivocal no, that the Republican National Chairman, George Bush, in my opinion, is one of the most decent, honorable men and one of the great national chairmen of this party. John Rhodes, who is the Republican leader of the House, has treated me only decently, honestly. Sometimes we've had differences of opinion. And I can say the same thing about my colleagues on this committee, the gentleman who sits to my left, who I regard as one of my best friends, except on the golf course, who happens to disagree with my views, I think, on this particular important matter. Let me say our job, as I view it, is to try to push aside partisan considerations, to try to be fair, to try to be judicious, to try to see that the president is afforded the same opportunities that have been afforded to other respondents in recent impeachment cases, There have been occasions when we've had substantial party divisions because some of us on the minority have not believed that the president has always been treated fairly procedurally. But I'll tell you, the end result has been the chairman, with some Democrats on the other side, has acquiesced and has usually ended up giving Mr. St. Clair the right to participate, the right to cross-examine, the right to call the witnesses that he wanted to call. I have two serious areas of concern in respect to the allegations of misconduct that have been leveled against the president. I will say unequivocally that I don't think a case has been made on the issue of the bribery charges on ITT, the bribery charges on the dairyman from the tapes that I've heard, the evidence that I've heard. I disagree with my good friend Henry Smith. I don't think that this president should be held to account for a bombing in Cambodia when those of you who have read The Best and the Brightest, the book by David Halberstam, have read probably the greatest indictment of the two previous administrations about untruths, distortions, statistics that were not accurate. But I do have some problems, and I want to share with my colleagues, I want to share with my constituents my concerns. They relate to what I would call the abuse of power. I can't think of an area where a conservative or a moderate or a liberal should be more concerned about the state of our government. On September 11th, John Dean called the Commissioner of Internal Revenue to his office, Commissioner Walters, where he submitted a so-called enemies list, which were McGovern contributors and McGovern supporters, and ordered the commissioner to audit those people. The commissioner didn't want to audit those people, resisted, said that he would have to check with Secretary Shultz. On September 15th, the president entered into a conversation with John Dean that began at 27 minutes after 5 and lasted until 17 minutes after 6. We have a tape recording of that conversation up until 6 o'clock. The other 17-minute segment has not been produced according to a subpoena. It's been subpoenaed by Jaworski. Judge Sirica was requested by Judge Sawarski, by Jaworski, the special prosecutor, to again listen to that 17-minute segment to see if it perhaps might not be relevant. The judge, in his reconsideration, determined that 13 of the 17 minutes were indeed relevant. According to John Dean's testimony, which has not yet been released but will be released, you will learn that, according to John Dean, and I think John Dean knows that that tape is going to be made public, that the president knew about this ordered audit. It was his impression that he knew about it beforehand. The president made some derogatory remarks about Secretary Shultz and called him something like a candy ass. I didn't send him over there to be a candy ass. And John Dean was told to go back and, if he needed any help, to contact the president. If there is anything that's going to affect adversely our democracy, our individual freedoms, it's a misuse of a sensitive agency like the IRS or the FBI or the CIA. Let me just tell you a little bit about Watergate, what concerns me about the Watergate cover-up. On August 29th, the president held a news conference where he stated that he had had the Department of Justice, the FBI, I think it was the GAO, he referred to the Banking and Currency Committee, and he said that he had directed his own counsel, John Dean, to investigate the Watergate to determine if there was any White House involvement. The truth of the matter is, as far as we know it anyway, the evidence, John Dean had never reported to him, had never been with the president. The White House logs show that. John Dean's testimony is to the effect that he didn't even know about such a report until the president's press conference. What was John Dean doing in the meantime? Well, for one thing, on June 19th, he was meeting with Mitchell, Magruder, and Mardian, at which meeting Jeb Magruder was told by John Mitchell that he ought to have a fire to burn some documents, incriminating evidence. Then they, on June 23rd, they decided when it was reported to them that there was some money involved that had perhaps been laundered in Mexico, that money that had gone to the creep. What did they do? And the president knew about this. Get a hold of the CIA to determine if perhaps the CIA shouldn't influence the FBI not to pursue that because of covert activities. For a while, the CIA agreed to that. They did make an investigation. They found there was absolutely nothing to hide. They went back. Dean still persisted and wanted them not to interview witnesses that were relevant. What did they do on June 28th? They established John Dean and Ehrlichman and Haldeman. There's evidence that they established a fund using the president's counsel, Kalmbach, to pay money. And I don't care what that money was paid for. I don't care whether you call it hush money or it was for defendants. The evidence is that then Pat Gray on July 6th, the director of the FBI, was so incensed that after a meeting with Walters, he first called Clark McGregor, and then the president called him, and Pat Gray felt compelled to tell the president, some of your top staff are mortally wounding you. Then we go into the period after that. On September 15th, the president finally did meet John Dean. On the 15th, the president, after talking to Haldeman, congratulated him for plugging leaks and talked about containment and something to the effect of cutting losses or buttoning it up or something like that. Then you go into the next period, March 21st. Let me say that I don't think the president directed the payment of hush money. And I don't think we can make that allegation. But let me tell you what happened. The president on March 20th ordered John Dean. Things were beginning to get a little hot. The president on March 20th ordered John Dean to conduct a report, another report. This is the second Dean report. He says, that's right. This is the president speaking. Try just something general. Like, I have checked into this matter. I can categorically, based on my investigation, the following. Haldeman is not involved in this, that, and the other thing. Mr. Colson did not do this. Mr. So-and-so did not do this. Mr. Blank did not do this. Right down the line, taking the most glaring things. If there are any further questions, please let me know. See? The next morning, John Dean advised the president that Ehrlichman was implicated, that Haldeman was implicated, that Magruder and Porter had perjured themselves, that John Dean himself was implicated. What did the president do at that point? Well, that afternoon, I won't say what he said about the hush money. They talked about the $1 million. They talked about the $120,000. It's important that we get that right away, isn't it? John Dean says it's important that we send a signal anyway. And so the president said, well, for Christ's sake, get it. Then there is another conversation, as my friend from New Jersey said, which kind of leaves that up in the air, however. But then later on that afternoon, again, the president referred to a report that he wanted Dean to write. Only this time, the president had knowledge of who was allegedly involved. And he says this, I don't want to get all that expletive deleted specific. I'm thinking now in far more general terms, having in mind the fact that the problem with a specific report is that this proves this one and that one and that one, and you just prove something, you didn't do it at all. But if you make it rather general, in terms of your investigation indicates that this man did not do it, this man did not do it, this man did not do it, and so forth. What happened after March 21st? The president ordered John Dean to go to Camp David to make a report. John Dean could not make that report. On September 5th, the president had a press conference. This was after everything had kind of blown up. The president, in his September 5th press conference, went back to the John Dean report and said, when it became apparent to me that John Dean couldn't make a report, I assigned it to John Ehrlichman, and this was March 27th, I believe. Now, what was the status of John Ehrlichman at that point? John Ehrlichman had already been implicated in the Watergate cover-up himself by John Dean on the morning of March 21st. John Ehrlichman denied that he had made any investigation at that point. Then we have John Dean blowing the whistle by going to the U.S. attorneys on June 8th, followed by Magruder on June 13th. Then LaRue, I think on June 14th, finally said, He said on June 14th, the jig is up. Silbert, the U.S. attorney, called Henry Peterson, the head of the criminal division, and he said, Henry, we have broken the Watergate case. Henry Peterson contacted Kleindienst. Finally, this began the mid-April meetings with Henry Peterson. Now, what happened at those mid-April meetings with Henry Peterson? On April 16th, from 1:39 to 3:25, the president met with Henry Peterson. At this meeting, the president promised to treat as confidential any information disclosed by Peterson to the president. The president emphasized to Peterson, you're talking only to me, and there's not going to be anybody else on the White House staff. In other words, I'm acting counsel and everything else. The president suggested that the only exception might be Dick Moore. When Peterson expressed some reservation about information, the president said, let's just better keep it with me then. In an afternoon conversation on that same day, a telephone conversation, when the president called Peterson, again he said, Henry, feel free to confide in me. I'm going to, in effect, keep it confidential. I know the rules of the grand jury. What did he do with the information that Henry Peterson gave to him? Henry Peterson, who was taking the place of Kleindienst as really the chief investigator in the Watergate case, the president on April 17th met with Haldeman, who had been implicated again by information that was given to Henry Peterson, and Henry Peterson had revealed it to the president, and the president advised at that point Haldeman that he better get together with John and map out some kind of a strategy on the money. Then there's a big deletion. I don't know what the material deleted is. Then he comes back and says, what about Kalmbach? Now, what is Kalmbach going to say about the money? He says to Haldeman, you better get a hold of Kalmbach and tell him that LaRue is speaking freely. I just wonder myself, I'm concerned about the president's actions, not so much early, not about the break-in or what happened earlier.
The time of the gentleman has expired. I recognize the gentleman from Missouri for purposes of general debate only.
Mr. Chairman, I yield 2 minutes to my distinguished colleague and neighbor from Illinois, Mr. Railsback.
Railsback is recognized for 2 minutes out of the gentleman's time.
I thank the gentleman for yielding. Let me just try to finish very briefly. It was shortly thereafter that on April 24th and April 25th, and I believe on April 26th, that the president ordered Haldeman to listen to certain tapes that I think only he and Haldeman knew had been made in the White House. Haldeman listened to tapes that were made in February and March. He reported to the president on April 26th, and he spent, I think it was 5 hours with the president. We've subpoenaed that tape because we think it's relevant, and it's had support from both Republicans and Democrats, and that's one of the tapes where Haldeman was reporting to the president after spending 2 days listening to these tapes, which we don't have. I just can't help but wondering, when you put all of this together in that kind of perspective, I am concerned, and I'm seriously concerned. I wish the president could do something to absolve himself. I wish he would come forward with the information that we've subpoenaed. I just am very, very concerned. Let me just say one thing in the remaining minute. Some of my friends from Illinois, I received all kinds of mail. Some of my people say that the country cannot afford, that we cannot afford to impeach a president. Let me say to my, many of these are good supporters and friends. Let me say to them, I've spoken to countless others, including many, many young people. And if the young people in this country think that we're going to not handle this thing fairly, if we're not going to really try to get to the truth, you're going to see the most frustrated people, the most turned off people, the most disillusioned people. And it's going to make the period of LBJ in 1968, 1967, it's going to make it look tame. So I hope that we just keep our eye on trying to get to the truth. Thank you.
Time of the gentleman has expired, and I recognize the gentleman from Missouri for the rest of his 13 minutes for a general debate only.
I thank the chairman, and I thank my distinguished colleague from Illinois for his discussion, and I hope that history will record you received the clearest explanation of this problem on the time of the gentleman from Missouri. Mr. Chairman, it has been my privilege to serve on this committee for 10 years since I came to Congress, and never have I been prouder of this committee and the privilege of serving on it than I am during this period of its most supreme testing. For weeks, even months, we have studied evidence, heard witnesses, and debated the solemn question of impeachment. The time has come for decisions. Further delay is unjustifiable. The time-consuming task of impeachment must go forward. Should Richard M. Nixon be found guilty of obstruction of justice? Yes. Should Richard M. Nixon be found guilty of abusing the powers of his office? Yes. Should Richard M. Nixon be found guilty of contempt and defiance of the Congress and the courts? Yes. And on the last charge, he is a repeated offender. We hear a great deal today about the presumably grim consequences of impeachment. An endless public trial, a people divided, a government paralyzed, a nation disgraced. But suppose the House should decide not to impeach. This would have consequences too, and they deserve careful examination. Refusal to impeach would be a decision as momentous as impeachment itself. It would and could be interpreted as meaning that the Congress does not think Mr. Nixon has done anything to warrant impeachment. It would alter the historic relationship of presidential power and the constitutional system of accountability for using that power. Our message to posterity would be that Mr. Nixon had conceived and established a new conception of presidential accountability, and his successors could expect to inherit Nixon's conception of inherent presidential authority and wield unshared power with which he endows the presidency. Failure to impeach would be a vindication of a new theory of presidential non-accountability. Many would shrink from this trying constitutional responsibility. Shrinking from impeachment probably arises from remoteness of contemporary presidents, from the difficulty of visualizing offenses of this administration. Perhaps the situation is more easily conceived if put in more homely local terms. A letter of Robert P. Weeks in the Ann Arbor News did this well, I think, and I would like to paraphrase it. Number one, suppose your mayor approved a plan by which the chief of police of your city could illegally tap your phone, open your mail, burglarize your apartment, your office, or your house. Suppose your mayor directed your hometown police and FBI agents to tap the phone of the local reporter covering City Hall, directed the FBI to investigate a newscaster for the local radio and TV station. Suppose your mayor withheld knowledge of a burglary from a local judge trying a case in which that knowledge was important. Suppose your mayor secretly taped conversations held in his office in your city hall between himself and citizens like yourself, as well as public officials. Then when a confirmed court order required him to turn over 9 of these tapes, refused to obey, then reversed himself, then announced 2 of the tapes containing the most critically important material did not exist. Suppose your mayor tripled his wealth while serving as mayor in your city. Suppose your mayor paid practically no income tax for several years because he claimed huge and legally dubious deductions for turning over his official papers to the local historical society. Suppose your mayor surreptitiously used city taxpayers' funds to make major improvement on 2 private homes he had. Suppose your mayor twice selected personally as mayor pro tem a man who had bribes delivered to him in City Hall, then resigned allegedly to avoid going to jail. Suppose your mayor selected and supervised as trusted top officials of his administration 10 men who were indicted, convicted, or pleaded guilty, including the city attorney. The citizens of your town wouldn't be complacent. Should we hold city's elected officials to 1 standard of conduct but have a lower, lax standard for the president? Inaction will say to the president and future presidents, well, there's practically no limit to the improprieties we'll put up with in the White House. The founding fathers wisely made impeachment a constitutional remedy. They did not want to make it easy to get rid of presidents, but they were determined to make it possible. If we wish to restore the historic system of accountability of presidents, the means are at hand, and the time is at hand. If we do not hold Mr. Nixon and his successors accountable except once every 4 years, we license an imperial presidency, usher in a new and, I believe, ominous time for our republic. We transform the balance and character of constitutional order. Impeachment may have grievous consequences. Refusal to impeach will have disastrous consequences. The transcripts have diminished the president's image from that of a moral man surrounded by underlings who betrayed him to that of an amoral man who compounded his troubles by withholding more than a year the shocking truth about the mess he and his administration were in. He shows a lack of concern for morality, a lack of concern for high principle, a lack of commitment to high ideals of public office that make the transcripts a sickening exposure. Richard Nixon is humorless to the point of being inhumane. He is devious. He is vacillating. He is profane. He is willing to be led. He displays dismaying gaps in knowledge. He is suspicious of his staff. His loyalty is minimal. His greatest concern is to create a record that will save himself and his administration. The high dedication to grand principles that Americans have a right to expect from a president is missing from the transcripts. I do not know how one of sound mind can read the transcripts and continue to think Mr. Nixon upheld the standards and dignity of the presidency, which he proclaimed himself as a candidate in 1960, 1968, and 1972. Involved here is not a question of Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, or of a conspiracy by his enemies to get the president. In the words of an old senatorial friend and presidential defender, Mr. Nixon took a principal role in a shabby, immoral, and disgusting performance. This is a matter of right or wrong, telling the truth or not telling the truth. Perhaps an old Missouri saying is appropriate. If the Lord loved a liar, he'd hug him to death. The issues here are broader than criminality. An individual's conduct may be indefensible and reprehensible without being criminal. Legal, constitution, and parliamentary history show an official may be removed for failing to do his job or for bringing scandal and disgrace to his office, losing his ability to govern effectively. The distinguished gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Sandman, mentioned James Madison. And on May 19, 1789, in the debates in the Congress concerning our Constitution, Mr. Madison said, quote, "I think it absolutely necessary that the president should have the power of removing his subordinates from office. It will make him in a peculiar manner responsible for their conduct and subject him to impeachment himself if he suffers them to perpetrate with impunity high crimes or misdemeanors against the United States or neglects to superintend their conduct so as to check their excesses." It is true this standard, this action may tempt opponents to seek removal of a president for political or otherwise inadequate reasons, as some believe they did with Andrew Johnson. But that risk must be accepted. The ultimate arbiter is the people. Public reaction today is clearly revulsion. Republican politicians defect from Mr. Nixon in droves. The evidence against Mr. Nixon is, in his own words, made public at his own direction. There can no longer be a charge he was railroaded out of office by vengeful Democrats or a hostile press. The fundamental questions have been answered. Filling in gaps in the transcripts only make the case stronger. Let's assume for a moment you were president of the United States, March 21st, 1973, and possessed of normal standards of honesty. One of your assistants comes to the office and says, "Mr. President, you remember the burglary at the Watergate? We are spending your campaign money to take care of the families of the men caught in that burglary and to pay their legal fees." What would you say? What would you do? Would you examine all your options? Would you say that would be perfectly legal, as Mr. Nixon has subsequently said of such payments? Or would you say something like this: "That money was raised to re-elect the President of the United States. Nobody in this office is going to use it to support burglars." You know, a man who is not a crook is not necessarily an honest man. We do not have to find Mr. Nixon guilty of a crime in order to find him unfit for this high office. Ask yourself the question, what would I have done if I learned funds given to me by people who believed in me and wished to secure my reelection were being used to support burglars? Would I have said, "That would be perfectly legal," and kept quiet for 40 days? Now ask yourself whether you think Richard Nixon is worthy to occupy the highest office in the gift of the people, and it's their office. It's hard not to appear silly, you know, or dishonest, when circumstances conspire to make you play two roles or speak about the same subject from opposing points of view. So with the President Nixon and the Watergate. It's reasonable for a man trying to run a government to insist that 1 year of Watergate is enough. It is reasonable for a man suspected of jailable offenses to do what he can to keep the prosecution from being able to prove what it suspects. But when administrator and suspect are one, it's hard to say anything without the appearance of self-serving dishonesty. As a result, Mr. Nixon is forever saying contradictory things. For instance, he is cooperating fully with the committee and the special prosecutor, even while he is denying documents and denying tapes that the prosecutor and this committee seek. Well, there's a way out. He could plead the Fifth Amendment, President Grant did during a congressional inquiry, and add to this the fact that he is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and you have perhaps the best defense that he might make. You know, the President spoke a lot about law and order in his day. Mr. Nixon said at Miami Beach in 68, it's time for some honest talk about the problem of law and order in the United States. If we're to restore order and respect for law in this country, there's one place to begin. We are going to have a new Attorney General of the United States. Well, you know, one day we had three, one every 15 minutes there. He says, Mr. Nixon says, I pledge to you that our Attorney General will be directed to launch a war against organized crime in this nation. Government can pass laws, but respect for law, Mr. Nixon says, can come only from people who take the law in their hearts and minds and not into their hands. Mr. Nixon said in 68, I believe in a system in which the appropriate cabinet officer gets credit for what goes right and the president takes blame for what goes wrong. Mr. Nixon said in 68, I believe in any system of government providing a method for peaceful change. There is no cause justifies breaking the law or engaging in violence. Mr. Nixon said in 73, March 14th, the only way to attack crime in America is the way crime attacks our people, without pity. Mr. Nixon said in 71, one final point. You talk about a police state. Let me tell you what happens when you go to a real police state. You can't talk in your bedroom. You can't talk in your sitting room. You don't talk on the telephone, Mr. Nixon says. You don't talk in the bathroom. As a matter of fact, you hear about going out and talking in the garden. I've walked many times through gardens where I had to talk about something confidential. You can't even talk in front of a shrub. That's the way it works, Mr. Nixon said. I'm simply saying this, my friends. There are police states, but we don't want that to happen in America. And as long as I'm in office, we're going to be sure that not the FBI or any organization engages in such activity. It goes on. On this committee, we're all lawyers. And to become lawyers, we took the same oath to uphold the Constitution that Richard M. Nixon took. To become congressmen and congresswomen, we took the same oath to uphold that Constitution which Richard M. Nixon took. If we are to be faithful to our oaths to support the Constitution, we must sign him faithless in his.
The time of the gentleman has expired, and the committee will recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
And so ends tonight's opening round of the impeachment debate before the House Judiciary Committee. The first such debate to take place before a congressional committee involving a president in more than 100 years. There were two dramatic and significant moments tonight during the opening round of discussion involving the 38 members of the Judiciary Committee. Both of these involved Republican congressmen from Illinois. The first came when GOP Representative Robert McClory of Illinois, who has been regarded as a fence-sitting GOP member, indicated that he is now tending toward voting for articles of impeachment that involve an article of abuse of power. Then a bit later, just a few minutes ago, we heard an impassioned speech by Congressman Tom Railsback, also from Illinois, who almost assumed a prosecutorial role in detailing many of the events that have tended to implicate the president in the Watergate case. Railsback stopped short of saying that he would actually vote for impeachment, but he certainly left a rather strong impression that he may well vote for impeachment. This could mean that at least three Republican members of the Judiciary Committee are now prepared to vote for articles of impeachment, but we still have to hear from 11 of the 18 GOP members who are yet to speak. And it is entirely likely that some of the members, some of the Republican members who have not yet spoken, also will indicate that they will vote for impeachment. As we have said before, most of the Democrats have indicated that they are ready to vote for impeachment. And in the eyes of many people, the Judiciary Committee, when it does wind up this debate, will approve a resolution of impeachment that will embrace two or perhaps three articles of impeachment against the president. I did think, Jim, that tonight the debate was conducted on a rather high level. I think that most of the members who spoke were aware of the historical impact that they were having as this was taking place on American television.
Well, I would agree, Paul. What struck me, of course, is the obvious thing of the differences in the style of these styles of these various congressmen. Some of them took the statesmanship approach. Others became prosecutors. Others, for instance, Congressman Sandman of New Jersey spoke almost like in a after dinner speech, almost an informal type of style. I think that once again, you have to be struck with the basic concept of criminal justice when you're listening to a criminal trial, where you have people who hear the same evidence and come up with two entirely different conclusions. And we saw this tonight. Let's go to Carolyn Lewis on the at the Judiciary Committee hearing.
Honestly, when I didn't have time to prepare a written statement, I decided that I would wing it with just some references to different materials that I had.
They're telling me we have 30 seconds, so let me just ask, you almost came to the brink of announcing your vote. Will you now?
I'm going to listen to all of the debate, and I think all of us are, you know, really taking it seriously. I want to hear what the other members have to say, too.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Razbeck, could you stay with us? We're still on the air. Mr. Razbeck, from what you said, you've made a very deep study of the evidence. Do you feel at this point at least you're leaning for impeachment of the president?
What I'm, what I wanted to convey is that there are some very, very serious questions which I think have to be answered. And I hope I also conveyed my concern that the White House has really not cooperated. In other words, it's very clear to me after I really did study the evidence and I've worked hard. It's very clear to me that some of those tapes that that we've subpoenaed with bipartisan support, in other words, some of those tapes had overwhelming Republican support, that they are relevant. And I just hope, you know, I meant what I said. I hope, I wish that the president would come forth with whatever he has and be candid and let's get this thing over with. Let's get to the truth. That's what the American people want.
Was this then a warning that you were issuing on public television here?
Listen, I've issued a lot of warnings, and I'm not in a position to warn anybody. I'm one member of 38 members on the committee that happens to be deeply concerned, that would like to give the president the benefit of the doubt, but is having difficulty giving him the benefit of the doubt.
But Mr. Railsback, you don't realistically think that there's any chance now that the president's going to step forward and do what you've suggested?
Yes, I do. I think the fact he's been ordered to turn over the 64 tape conversations to the special prosecutor, I think the committee ought to ask him at the same time to make, at least of those, make copies for us. I think you ought to go even further. I think you ought to turn over the other materials as well.
We've just been talking to Congressman Railsback.
Thank you, Carolyn. Carolyn Lewis, our Capitol Hill reporter, who has been on the scene. Well, what have we learned tonight? Well, we had 11 members who spoke up. There were 6 members, all Democrats, who indicated rather plainly that they will vote for impeachment. We had 2 who indicated that they will vote against impeachment, and they were both Republicans. And then we had 3 who also were Republicans who indicated that they could vote, that they could, they didn't say definitely, that they could vote for one or more articles of impeachment. Now, Jim is at a tote board, a tote board, which we have rigged up here in our studios to give you some clearer conception of how the committee does line up and how the vote may proceed and just what may happen when they do finally get around to voting articles of impeachment. Jim?
Paul, this board reflects where the best guesses were, at least when the day began today, as to where or for ayes, four impeachment, 19 votes. That's 18 Democrats and one Republican, Congressman Hogan of Maryland, who announced yesterday that he would definitely vote for impeachment. The nays, all Republicans, seven. Five maybe nays, all Republicans, and seven maybe ayes, four impeachment, breakdown, three Southern Democrats and four Republicans. Now, what I want to do now with your help, Paul, and Carolyn's help, to see if we ought to need, if we need to make some changes based on what happened today and particularly what we heard tonight. I would think that the ayes would remain the same. Any disagreements there of the people we heard tonight, Kastenmeier, Edwards, Brooks, Donahue, and Hungate, they pretty well confirmed their position, so there'd be no changes there. Would you agree?
I agree.
Carolyn?
Congressman McClory, earlier this evening, you indicated that you might very well vote an article of impeachment on the president, particularly on the grounds that he has refused to hand over evidence. Am I correct in summing up that that's the way you're leaning?
Yes, I feel very strongly that the president should comply with our subpoenas and actually furnish all of the materials that we requested. And since he refused, why, I feel that some action should be taken. And it is a valid ground for impeachment, I think, that the president has, in a sense, defied the Congress by refusing to provide the information we have required in connection with our investigation. Now, since the Supreme Court decision, it seems to me that this provides added grounds for this proposed article. And I'm hopeful, on the other hand, that the president and his counsel will see fit to deliver the materials to us without without having to take action by way of impeachment.
You're a senior member of this committee. Do you plan to go into some kind of negotiations with the White House, perhaps through Gerry Ford, to try and get that material?
Yes, I was rather surprised that the White House, neither Mr. St. Clair in his earlier announcement nor any other information forthcoming from the White House did include a mention of delivery of this material to our committee, because it seems to me that we have even a superior right to the information than that of the court. But I know that Mr. McCahill, Mr. St. Clair's assistant, was in the hearing room here this evening, and if I don't talk to Mr. St. Clair, I'll at least talk to Mr. McHale or have one of our counsel talk with him and see if we can't get the material we require. Now, if it could be forthcoming within a period of a few weeks or a month, I would say definitely that we should delay any final report to the House of Representatives in order that we have this fuller information.
Thank you very much, Mr. McClory. Thank you, sir.
Well, our intrepid reporter, Carolyn Lewis, has done it again. She has just drawn from Congressman McClory a further statement, which now seems to imply that he most definitely is prepared to vote for one or more articles of impeachment. So, Jim, I think you should change your tote board there.
All right, yes. McClory is now, or when the day began, was considered a maybe nay. Are we saying put him down into a maybe aye at this point, right? At least on the issue of subpoenaed evidence. All right. Any more changes in the nays? I'd say no. There's seven all Republicans. The two men who spoke tonight, Edward Hutchinson and Charles Sandman, certainly confirmed their position. Sandman did say if somebody demonstrated in a very graphic way the smoking gun theory, at least, that he would vote for impeachment, but the chances are he will not. Okay, on the maybe nays, we've lost one, McClory and Smith. I would say Smith would have to be classified as a nay now, would you not?
I would, very definitely.
All right, because he pretty well said nothing except the Cambodian bombing, and that is probably not going to get off the ground in a serious way. So we have that change. That leaves these three gentlemen, David Dennis, Wiley Main, and Harold Froelich, all Republicans on the maybe nays. All right, on the maybe ayes, what about Tom Railsback? He's the only other one down here who spoke. We just heard him again. I guess he would have to stay in that same category. He certainly did not say he was definitely going to vote for impeachment, at least even though he gave strong indications. Any other changes that you would make, Paul?
I think that does it, Jim.
Okay.
Now we would like to go back to Barbara Tuchman and ask you for your impression of tonight's debate, Ms. Tuchman.
Well, I was struck by one remark in the gentleman from Missouri, Hungate?
Mr. Hungate.
When he just happened to say that the kind of conduct that the American people have a right to expect. I think this is a very basic issue in this whole business. What we expect, what we have a right to expect of our institutions. And it seems to me we are in an era where perhaps our institutions, and not only government, are not working in the way that we have in the past expected. And I shouldn't draw the analogies from the Middle Ages. I have a tendency lately to do this all the time because I'm working in a book on the 14th century, but at the moment, it's so striking that I would like to make the comparison because the 14th century was a period which, to put it in the words of a famous historian, was a bad time for humanity for various reasons, plague and war and violence and disillusion. And I find it very similar to the 20th. And one of the fundamental troubles was that institutions that people had believed society was organized in weren't working the way they expected. As you know, in those days, the political structure was based on the so-called three estates, which people assumed God had arranged as permanent orders of society, the clergy, the nobles, and everybody else, the commoners, and the clergy was supposed to. Each had a function for the good of the whole. That was the theory. The clergy would pray for everyone and communicate between lay society and the divine. And the nobles would fight to protect the church, avert the oppression of the poor, uphold virtue, and combat tyranny. The commoners would work so that everybody could eat. That is, they would till the soil. They would provide commodities of life through trade and commerce. But the first two orders, by this time, were simply not performing their functions in a way that people had any confidence in, because the church had become, I'm afraid I'm going on now on a, too long, on a something that has nothing to do with tonight's, except in a larger sense it has to do with it. That the clergy, the church, the whole hierarchy from Pope right down to priest had become held in contempt and corrupt and sunk in a kind of degree of worldliness and monetary values that destroyed all spiritual power. The nobility, the knights who were supposed to fight and protect the people, were doing anything but. They were the real oppressors. They were committing violence that was destroying all goods and all security. And to wrap this up quickly, the confidence in the institutions, the orders of society, was simply disintegrating. And this caused tremendous upheavals and revolts and revolution and distress and violence and psychological torment. And people themselves then failed to behave because they saw no proper conduct on the part of their so-called betters. Well, I know it seems far-fetched to relate this, to use this as an analogy to the present, but that's the way I see it. I think we have, for very good reason, lost confidence in the people want to look up to, whether we do anything.
And that is the president, obviously. Well,
and more than that.
Well, we want to thank you for coming here and appearing and taking part in our discussion, Ms. Tuchman. Jim, we've had the first round tonight, and I must say that I certainly was struck by that. Just sitting in on this great moment of history as it took place, we had 11 members of the Judiciary Committee who spoke tonight. Tomorrow we will hear more members, and the debate will proceed tomorrow morning. And it will proceed with the president's most ardent supporter, Charles Wiggins, first in order. He followed then by John Conyers, probably one of the president's most severest critics, the Democrat from Detroit, Michigan. We will also be back tomorrow night at 7:30 Eastern Time. If the committee is still in live session, as it is expected to be, we will pick it up live and then give you a videotape replay at the following of that, of the daytime session, which does begin at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Again, our thanks to Barbara Tuchman. For Paul Duke and Impact, I'm Jim Lehrer. Thank you and good night.
Washington, you have been watching live, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the House Judiciary Committee proceedings. Production funding provided by public television stations, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This has been a production of NPACT, a division of GWETA.